Project line, the chairman of the West John Fellowship, to now talk mostly to John's book. Is that would be fair?
Partly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I too have to sit. I've just had an operation on my knee, so I can't wander around as I would like to do. Yes, I was part of the. Well, there's a small group of us actually planned this conference with John, and. So I partly want to talk to you about the discussions that we had and the kind of thinking that went on and some of my own thoughts about that as well. And we thought it was important to... Because John has written a book, World Crisis and Buddhist Humanism. And so we thought it would be very relevant to this conference. And we thought it would be useful to relate that to what we're doing here. And I'd written a review of John's book, and John thought it was it seemed to represent more or less his thinking. He thought it was a good representation of his thinking, and was very pleased with it. Partly, I think, because it was very flattering of his book, actually. But so I volunteered to have a go at that, and it's not an easy task because if you've read the book, you'll realise there's a great deal in it. And what I hope to do is to be able to get to the heart of one of the main messages in it. When we were planning this course, this conference, we were thinking not in terms of being an academic. We've got a lot of speakers, but we didn't want it to be an academic, us learning about engaged Buddhism conference. This is about us. It's about involvement. So it's really about about action and the action that we can take. Not everybody here, of course, is part of the Western Chan Fellowship, but our particular approach to Buddhism involves fairly intensive meditation. We go on in retreats. People tend to often have quite meaningful experiences. So the question then is, that's fine, we go on the retreat, have some sort of experience. How does that translate into daily life? And probably it translates very well into daily life. But there's also a question about, do we need to do more? Is it also useful that we share with each other when we come away from retreat? And so that's part of the thinking of this conference as well. Will we learn more by actually discussing and thinking about what we do, how we engage? Part of the while I was actually preparing this, Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi was invited to the conference and was going to come, but unfortunately was unable to come for health reasons. And he has set up an organisation called Buddhist Global Relief. He's someone who's also translated many of the Pali scriptures. And interesting person. While I was preparing this talk, I looked up some of the things that he'd written, and I came across this, which is a challenge to Buddhists. And I think it encapsulates some of what we were thinking about. So I'll just read it out to you. I am awed by the enormity of the suffering that assails human beings on every continent, and even more by the hard truth that so much of this suffering springs from the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion raging in the human heart. Seeing the immensity of the world's anguish has raised in my mind questions about the future prospects for Buddhism in the West. It seems to me that we Western Buddhists tend to dwell in a cognitive space that defines the First Noble Truth largely against the background of our middle-class lifestyles, as the gnawing of discontent, the ennui of oversatiation, the pain of unfulfilling relationships, or with a bow to Buddhist theory, as bondage to the round of rebirths. Too often I feel our focus on these aspects of dukkha has made us oblivious to the vast, catastrophic suffering that daily overwhelms three-fourths of the world population. An exception to this tendency may be found with the engaged Buddhist movement. I believe this is a face of Buddhism that has great promise, but I'm struck by two things. First, while some engaged Buddhists seek fresh perspectives from the Dharma, for many, Buddhism simply provides spiritual practices to use while simultaneously espousing socio-political causes, not much different from those of the mainstream left. Second, engaged Buddhism still remains tangential to the hard core of Western interest in Buddhism, which is the Dharma as a path to inner peace and self-realization. If Buddhism in the West becomes solely a means to pursue personal spiritual growth, I'm apprehensive that it may evolve in a one-sided way and thus fulfill only half its potential. Attracting the affluent and cultural elite, but it will risk turning the quest for enlightenment into a private journey that in the face of the immense suffering which daily hounds countless human lives can present only a resigned quietism. It is true that Buddhist meditation practice requires seclusion and inwardly focused depth, but wouldn't the embodiment of Dharma in the world be more complete by also reaching out and addressing the grinding miseries that are ailing humanity? So I thought, well, that's quite challenging. That is a good challenge. There's something to answer. There are a number of assumptions in there that we might question, but it's, in a way, that I think provides quite an interesting starting point. And I particularly think is relevant because it gives, he's talking about a global perspective. As Simon was saying, there's how we live our daily lives. But we're in a context, in a world which is increasingly clearly related. And in fact, has always been like that. We've perhaps not always been necessarily so aware as we are now. So although I think engaged Buddhism might well have moved on since 2007 when that was written, it still seems like a highly relevant question. So in our discussions and our planned discussions, we also particularly wanted to explore further the relationship between meditation practice and engaged Buddhism. One of John's chief concerns, I think people who knew him well, we've heard this many times, as a Dharma teacher, was that the Dharma shouldn't be dumbed down. And I think his view would be that social engagement that's not inspired by the bodhisattva vow of enlightenment or waking up would be important, but it wouldn't be engaged Buddhism. So this is how he would have seen it. Meditation practice is very serious work. It involves a confrontation with the self that can be transformative. It needs to be the foundation for Buddhist involvement in social concerns. But there's also a possibility of meditation practice becoming a kind of preoccupation of its own. As Simon was saying, searching for one's own enlightenment, one's own peace, and not necessarily relating further out. So that was really, if you like, a part of the background thinking that we... So in a sense, we're setting up a challenge to ourselves, particularly, I suppose, because of our particular approach to Buddhism. We wanted to challenge ourselves through this conference and actually help ourselves evolve and think further. And what is engaged Buddhism? I'm sure you're aware that the word was coined by Thich Nhat Hanh, who during the catastrophe of the Vietnam War was concerned that the hierarchy, if you like, the Buddhist hierarchy, was unengaged with the issue. There's a war going on, and we're still staying in our monasteries and not doing anything. So younger monks were not happy with this, younger monks and nuns. And so they actually decided that it was necessary to act. And engaged Buddhism really was the term that they came up with, for what they were doing. And if you look up, if you go onto YouTube, I'm afraid this is one of my ways of doing research. If you go onto YouTube and put in the question, "What is engaged Buddhism?" the first thing you'll find is Thich Nhat Hanh. And he's talking about an answer that he gave to an Italian reporter who asked him that question, what is engaged Buddhism? And he said, first of all, he said, it's the kind of Buddhism that you practice, that you do all day long. So his point was that defining engaged Buddhism in terms of the activities you do is not enough. Sure, there are things that people do, but actually how are you doing? How aware are you when you're actually doing them? So the kind of thing you do all day long in every aspect of life. Now this is somebody obviously who's prioritised and very serious social issues. So there's also, I think, another element to it, which is the kind of Buddhist, you could say, a kind of Buddhist practice you do all day long that's in relationship, that's relating. Might be another way of talking about engagement. And in a way, I think that this is very similar to the view that John was expressing as well, that the engagement and Buddhism, they need to be somehow or another interrelated. They're not separate from each other. So you could say, if you like, that that Dharma practice and engaged Buddhism, in a sense, are the same thing, in a certain way. So given that definition, is there a sense in which even someone who withdraws from society could be considered an engaged Buddhist? It seems counterintuitive to say that, and it's one of the issues, of course. If you look at the history of Chan Buddhism, you could make a very strong argument for the fact that although Chan Buddhism talks a lot about engagement, there are some very questionable aspects to that if you look at the history of Chan. So it's actually, quietism is a potential relevant challenge. But nevertheless, is there some sense in which that's true? So I raise this with John, because anybody who knows John know that in a way John was a kind of frustrated hermit. He is frustrated because he loved being with people. And so I raised this question with him. You know, is there some sense in which a hermit can be engaged Buddhist? And he had a very interesting answer. John was a founding member of the International, I've forgotten the name of it actually, Society of Ladakhi Studies. The name of it actually is the Association for Ladakh Studies. And he told us a story about he had a conversation with a Ladakhi woman. And she was, because one of the things that John did was research on the yogins of Ladakh. He went to visit and meet people who lived in the caves. And he's written a very interesting book on the yogins of Ladakh. And so he spoke to one of the women, relatively recently, who lives in there. And she said that all the caves now are empty. The hills, the mountains are empty. There's a feeling that the mountains had actually become empty. There was no one there anymore. Just imagine the profound impact of knowing in your society, which is a Buddhist society with a certain set of traditions, knowing that there are hermits who actually have roughly the same sorts of traditions up in the mountains. There is a relationship. So in one sense, even maybe a hermit can be an engaged Buddhist. There's a paradox here, because this is the very sort of thing that might be challenged. You might say, well, that's not engaged Buddhism. But let's not sweep it away too soon, too easily. Because it raises a very interesting question. In our race, fast, often mindless world, what are the roots that are needed for social engagement to be nourished and nourishing? And for it to have meaning. So there's a really interesting issue there. And but part of the reason for bringing in the example of the hermit is to be provocative. It's to say that actually there must be some sense in which we need to work out for ourselves what our engagement actually means, what kind of engagement works for us. It seems to me that the fields of activity for engaged Buddhism are limitless. In fact, in every situation that we can find ourselves. So political and social influence relating to people can be exerted in lots of different ways. A Buddhist activist might be active challenging institutions and structures from outside of those structures, on the street or camping down on the college green, for example, or through working with the organizations that are already established, such as the ones that are on the tables here. Buddhist professionals can influence the organizations within which they work. Buddhist politicians, if there are any Buddhist politicians in the UK, can influence government. Scientists, Buddhist scientists, can influence through their invention, innovation, ideas. Buddhist educators can help shape the thinking of young people and influence educational policy. Buddhist parents can encourage social and political awareness in their children. It's not necessary to espouse Buddhism in those situations, but engaged Buddhist practice is conceivable in all those and many other settings. So it seems to me to be very wide. So engaged Buddhism is not so much defined by types of contribution as actually by an approach. And there are a number of different ways that this has been explored. One way of exploring it is to list a set of principles, if you like, guiding principles. And Thich Nhat Hanh's organization has done that, 14 precepts of engaged Buddhism, which are very well worth exploring. Donald Rothberg and Diana Winston, who are two leaders in the engaged Buddhist movement in the USA, have published 10 guiding principles. And there are some differences between the two systems, or approaches rather, and there's overlap. But the certain themes come through. Compassionate action, not merely compassion without action. Not being bound by dogma, theory, or precedent, including Buddhist theories. An attitude of not knowing, an openness to ideas. Honest self-examination. Non-violence, a peaceful attitude in words and action. Openness to suffering. Interconnectedness or interbeing. Transforming anger. Mindful moment-to-moment awareness, right livelihood, caring for oneself, and ethical personal behavior. There's one difference between the two sets of principles. The community of interbeing include not accumulating wealth, whereas the Rothberg and Winston set don't actually mention this at all. Well, accumulating wealth has become a very, very topical issue at the moment. And I want to talk about this. In the process of preparing this talk, I've actually become quite shocked at a particular thing. I'll take you through it. It's not that I've discovered anything I didn't actually know. It's that the jigsaw puzzle, the pieces of the puzzle came together in a certain way. So I want to try and convey that. It's well known, of course, that purchasing power, there are a number of indicators for how you measure relative wealth. The one that's the kindest to the West is called purchasing power per capita. So even with that relatively kind indicator, North America and Europe have between 3 and 5 times the average purchasing power per capita in the world, average for the world. In India, it's a third of the average for the world. In China, it's 3/4 of the average. Per capita consumption is falling slightly in Europe and the USA, with the kind of consequences that we're seeing, actually. Very difficult. Whereas it's rising rapidly, 8% per year in China and India. And there are similar rises in other developing countries. At the same time, world population is increasing by about 80 million people per year. And it's been doing that for 50 years. It's very topical because on Monday, world population is estimated to reach 7 billion. And it's set to continue to increase by 80 million people per year for another 25 years. That'll be 9 billion in 2050, as we know, 9 point something, and may continue after that, depending upon birth rates. So the peak population will, in part, or very substantially actually, be determined by family planning in developing countries and access to education for women and girls. And it's a particularly important, significant issue in sub-Saharan Africa. Earlier this year, a number of us visited China, went on a trip to China. And one thing that struck, we went to was a tour of Buddhist monasteries. And one of the things that struck me most about that was that China seemed to me to be like a vast building site. It is incredible. Everywhere you go. It was when we came back to the UK and we drove from, we got off the plane and we drove from Leeds back to York. It's wonderful, there are no cranes. But everywhere in China, virtually all the road transport is lorries carrying building materials. All the barges on the Yangtze, things carrying building materials. We saw mountains being taken down in order to make space for cities. There's one area of China where they've actually taken 6 mountaintops and taken those off and filled the valleys in order to make a flat area. It's vast. It's perhaps a bit like the United States was in the end of the 19th and early 20th century, but on a much faster scale, much bigger equipment, much grander scale, bigger population, of course. We went through some cities that have a population of 20 million people. No, many, actually. There are quite a few in China. I think about 13 or 14. Some of these cities are built within a very few years. And we went through other cities that are in construction with areas and areas of skyscrapers which are still to be, for people to live in, which are still not yet, people haven't yet moved into. Just think of the infrastructure that goes with that. The schools, the railways, the hospitals, the police stations, the prisons, business districts, sports facilities, shopping. Vast. And it gives you a kind of context for trying to grasp the long-term implications of a population rise of 20 million people every 3 months for 75 years. One of those cities every 3 months. That's 300, actually. And these cities are actually being built. There's a construction boom, which is worldwide, in China, India, Indonesia, and the African countries. But also, believe it or not, in the United States, which is one of the richest countries in the world. In fact, the construction boom in China is the largest, but the United States is the second in the world, and will continue to be the second for quite a long time to come. And here's a quote for you from the director of Oxford Economics, which is a forecasting consultancy. Construction will become one of the exciting global growth industries of the next decade. So, very big. There's also, when we were there, there was a mini construction industry in building, rebuilding monasteries as well. There was a number of Chinese monasteries being rebuilt. Another way to think about this is to think about the population of Great Britain, 60 million people being added every 9 months for 70 years. Now again, just think what we take as being, just basic to our way of living. Libraries, post offices, they're very topical at the moment. roads, railways, health centres, schools, universities, swimming pools, and on and on and on. At the current rate of population increase, the reality is that development in many countries will lag far behind. You see, we often think about population, we think about can we feed people, can we provide water? But actually, if we want to provide our level of standard, it's not just that, it's like reproducing the whole of this country every 9 months. Well, we couldn't do it, could we? It's impossible. It's not going to happen, is it? We say that the world cannot sustain high rates of economic growth, partly because of the strong correlation between economic growth and carbon dioxide production. Clearly one of the drivers to this is the impact of population. So will our two types of way of living meet somewhere in the middle? Will the West meet somewhere in the middle near the countries that are developing countries? Well, interesting question. So it's quite understandable that a community that's led by a monk who's renounced wealth might include that particular statement about not accumulating wealth. But where do we as lay Western Buddhists, actually who've not renounced accumulating wealth, where do we stand on this issue? I'd like to introduce another principle, and it's the principle of granito. Granito is the name of a film about the aftermath of genocide which occurred in Guatemala in the 1980s. And over many years since that time, people have sought justice. The people who've been doing that have received death threats, a number of people have been murdered. But some people have carried on, they've actually pursued it, and in recent years some senior military people who were responsible for those for that genocide have actually been imprisoned as a consequence of the work that they did, they kept going. So granito is the Spanish word for a grain of sand. There are two issues about a grain of sand. One is it's kind of slightly awkward. It's a little bit sharp. There's a willingness to be a little bit awkward in the service of truth. It's also quite hard. It's hard to break down a grain of sand. And the third thing about it is it's very, very small. It's actually a single grain of sand. Yeah, we are very, very, we are very, very small. We can only do a tiny, tiny amount in this vast world. And I want to add something else as well. Another word for interbeing, which is Ubuntu. Ubuntu is an African word from the Bantu languages, and it means, I am what I am because of who we all are. Archbishop Desmond Tutu said this about Ubuntu. Ubuntu speaks to the very essence of being human. If you have Ubuntu, you are generous, hospitable, friendly, caring, and compassionate. You share what you have. It is to say, my humanity is inextricably bound up in yours. We belong in a bundle of life. I just love that phrase. A person is a person through other persons. A person with Ubuntu is open and available to others, affirming of others, does not feel threatened that others are able or good. For he or she has a proper self-assurance that comes from knowing that he or she belongs in a greater whole and is diminished when others are humiliated and diminished, when others are tortured or oppressed, or treated as if they were less than who they are. What you do affects the whole world. When you do well, it spreads out. It is for the whole of humanity. And I'm sure you're aware that, I'm sure you'll realize that Ubuntu was the spirit behind the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. The community of interbeing, Thich Nhat Hanh group, also has one other precept that's different from the others in that it refers to the specific responsibilities of a religious community. It says, do not use the Buddhist community for personal gain or profit, or transform your community into a political party. A religious community, however, should take a clear stand against oppression and justice and should strive to change the situation without engaging in partisan conflicts. Obviously, not everybody here is in the Western Chan Fellowship, but that's fine. Part of the aim of this conference is to develop a sense of sangha within and between groups. And it may well be that from this conference some shared activity comes out. Well, as at the beginning, the title of this talk is Buddhist Humanism. And it's part of the title of John's book. In a sense, you know, all of John's book is about Buddhist humanism, but he actually hardly mentions it in the book. I think he does for about a page. But I'll give you a brief summary, as I understand it, of the central message of the book. It's a little bit sort of tricky, this. So, according to Rhys Davids, who was one of the tricky in sense, is very concise. One of the pioneers of Buddhist interest in UK said that the Buddha was one of the first humanists in the world. And there's actually a huge overlap between the value systems of humanism and engaged Buddhism. Both value ethics and a duty of care to future generations. They place importance on peace and compassion, the constructive use of rational thought and science, human rights, personal liberty combined with social responsibility, rejection of dogmatism, non-theism, and ethical means of addressing the challenges of our times. So the overlap isn't complete because there's no specific reference to enlightenment in the Buddhist sense, and in human beings are actually very central stage, of course, held very central stage, less reference to all sentient beings. Not to say there isn't concern for other sentient beings, obviously. Now, in his book, John argues that the encounter between religion and science that had creative origins during the Renaissance nevertheless resulted in a polarization of views, and the side of science actually won out. And that then left a void that originally had been filled by God or the gods. The nature of this void was misunderstood. And as a consequence, humanity has veered towards a dangerous nihilism or despair. Nihilism has shaped our view of the world, our worldview, if you like. This is important because we're not necessarily aware of our worldview. We're not necessarily aware that our worldview is conditioned. It simply seems to be, if you don't think about it, the way the world actually is. So a nihilistic worldview suggests depressing answers to some interesting and challenging questions. Are we simply biological machines? Is there any place for meaning? And in the scheme of things, does it really matter whether human beings are kind or tyrannical? Does it matter whether we learn to live sustainably on this vast planet or not? A seemingly meaningless sense of void has also given power to a materialistic philosophy and an enhanced tendency to believe that the void can be filled with material wealth. But, of course, this tendency has become unsustainable. I say, of course, I think it has. But the second part of the argument of the book is that it's actually disingenuous, because this has all been argued in the name of the Enlightenment, or humanism, you could say. It's actually disingenuous to question the fundamentals of theism without also turning one's attention to the fundamentals of nihilism, especially when nihilism is very cleverly disguised as knowledge. So John does this from what he calls a Buddhistic perspective. Buddhist teachings founded on the premise that there's a middle way between fundamentalism and eternalism, or the world of the gods. The world of the gods and nihilism. So the void left by the departure of the gods that's ordinarily interpreted nihilistically needs to be investigated. Not by objective empirical means, because that doesn't really lead anywhere except into endless analytical thought, but by an equally credible subjective empiricism. In a rigorous investigation, nothing is assumed, so paradox can arise. For example, who is it that's investigating? Is there a separation between the investigation and the investigator? What is it to be a self? When we investigate experience, is a self doing it? Is self examining itself? I just noticed the time. 10 minutes, okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah, it's going to be fine, yeah. So John argues that what we call the self is essentially narrative, and let me read you something from his book. In meditation, the narrative of self floats free in a space-like open awareness wherein judgment or analysis no longer apply, because these are both attributes solely of the narrative and not of its basis. The surprising fruits of this investigation can fundamentally alter the way that we see the world, which allows a shift from a worldview to a worldview that is not basically materialistic or nihilistic. And that's a necessary precursor to a sustainable way of living on this planet. And John's argument is that we can try to solve individual problems, we can work on issues, but actually without a fundamental change in our worldview, in other words, an opening to a different worldview, it continues to be palliative, and not actually therefore going to lead to the kind of scale of change that is necessary. And the challenges we're talking about are ones, of course, that are on a vastly different scale from the ones in the Buddha's lifetime. If you want to know what the population was like in the Buddha's lifetime, imagine that we all represent the whole world's population. But at the time of the Buddha's life, there would just be two people in the room, possibly one. So it's different. For a Buddhistic worldview to be taken seriously, it needs to be expressed credibly and rigorously. And of course, John in his book does this very well. I recommend it to you, actually. Clive's selling them at break time, so if you've not actually read it. You will see how well argued, because it has to be capable of being able to stand up to philosophical investigation, a scientific, rigorous approach to understanding. Empirical, subjective empirism is not a sort of flimsy idea. It's actually something that's quite well grounded. John then goes on to write, at the very end, there are chapters on transformative education and meditation in practice. And the book ends by placing emphasis on the need for a fundamental change in the way that we educate young people and children. And as well as giving pointers on how each person can discover for themselves what a middle way approach to living really means. John's particular ideas, I think, probably will not quite take off. They're sort of rather specialised and involve quite a lot of the things that he liked doing in his own life, like being in places without electric lights and so on. But the basic point, is that an education which is founded not on competition, but actually on cooperation and collaboration, from what he would consider a Buddhistic perspective, without necessarily being Buddhist, is the argument he was making. I didn't want to include in the title of my talk the other part of John's thing, which is World Crisis. I wanted some wriggle room. I wanted to hold on to a corner of denial, you see. Because actually I'm very suspicious of the idea of an apocalypse. I think that there is an issue in the idea of an apocalypse, which is that the whole world finishes at the same time as me, and therefore it doesn't go on blithely without me. So I'm very suspicious of that. But it is the case that the problems that are faced are absolutely vast. And that's why I've been so shocked, just taking account of all these numbers I've been mentioning to you, the number of us. So while it's a very odd thing that none of us are going to know, are we, whether the human race is going to go on for a long time in the future. We're just not going to know. We'll all be gone. We just won't know. But what we can know is that what we do know will affect enormously, or has the potential rather, to affect the amount that people suffer in the future. There is something for us to do in terms of reducing suffering. And so in this process of preparing this talk, I actually feel I've run out of wriggle room, really. Because I think we're on a course of testing the capacity of the biosphere to sustain life. Probably the biosphere will win. But we are playing with fire, and in a literal sense, because the whole time that we're just now, and the whole time that we've been alive, there's been a fire burning in all the engines, the car engines of the world, the aeroplanes, in the bowels of industry. There's a continuous fire going on as we produce carbon dioxide as a consequence. There are a huge number of people whose collective knowledge and will to find solutions to the problem of our age is absolutely mind-boggling. You know, we're not alone in this. There are masses and masses of people who are trying to do something. So there's every reason for us to contribute our own grain of sand to this mass, huge effort. We don't have to do it all. There are actually 7 billion of us, and quite a lot are very well-intentioned. We're all familiar with the four vows of the Bodhisattva, which are expressed in different ways. In the Western Chan Fellowship, we say, I vow to deliver innumerable sentient beings. I vow to cut off endless vexations. I vow to master limitless approaches to Dharma. I vow to attain supreme Buddhahood. Of course, they're impossible. There's no calculation involved. There's a willingness to continue in that sense. And they may need to be rewritten in modern language. But these vows are somewhere in the roots of engaged Buddhism.